I'm Richard Burnaby, and welcome to another episode of Beyond the Lens, where I speak with inspiring people from around the world on photography, the arts, travel, conservation, entrepreneurship, and creative culture. Today, I'm speaking with a mountaineering legend, and I don't use that word legend lightly or very often, but in this case, it's warranted. Conrad Anker is one of the most accomplished and celebrated high-altitude climbers in the world. He summited Everest 3 times, including a successful 2012 expedition without the aid of supplemental oxygen. And on a 1999 trip to Everest, Conrad discovered the body of George Mallory, the famous British mountaineer who disappeared on the mountain in 1924 with his climbing partner, Andrew Irving. He's made many notable first ascents from Alaska to the Himalayas to Antarctica, not always choosing the highest peaks, but the most difficult. His Meru expedition in 2015 with Jimmy Chin and Renan Özturk being a notable example. He was leader of the North Face climbing team for 26 years. He's an author, ardent environmentalist, and a genuinely nice, gracious human being. I'm grateful he chose to join me on this podcast. And so here he is, without further ado, Conrad Anker. Conrad, it's an honor, sir. Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, Richard, thanks for the invitation.
I'm a longtime admirer. I was introduced to you mostly through the writings of my phantom photography mentor, Galen Rao, with whom I know you've had a friendship. And I say Galen was a phantom mentor because I never actually met him, but still he taught me more about photography, what it means, the importance of preserving wild places more than anyone else I know. And we're going to talk about Galen a bit later, but first, if you don't mind, I'd like to talk a little bit about you, if that's okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's start with climbing. Climbing has given you a livelihood. Climbing has allowed you to take care of your family. Climbing has given you worldwide acclaim and fame. I know you probably feel uncomfortable with that because you're a modest guy, but it's true. Climbing has given you lucrative endorsements. Climbing has given you so much. And at the same time, climbing has taken much from you. But when you strip all that away, the fame, the livelihood, the sponsors, the love, the loves, and the losses, to where it's just you and the mountain, what does climbing really mean to you?
Well, great question and wonderful introduction to our podcast here. Probably the most connected I feel to another human is when we're on a mountain together, we're doing a climb. So In a recreation sense, obviously with my family and everything, it's a different type of thing. But for recreation, when you're outdoors and you tie in and your life is in another person's hands, then you have that, there's that trust that goes with it. And when you and I go do a climb, it's about overcoming gravity. It's not about bettering another human as defined by a set of rules and a ball and judges and all that stuff. It's like the original sport.
I noticed that, like the documentary Meru, there was very little celebration. There's almost a respect for the mountain. There's not a lot of Yahoo, and you know, there's a little bit of that, but there's still a great deal. There's a great deal of respect. Not a lot of, you know, we won type attitude.
Yeah, that's a good observation. When you go out into the mountains, you know that you're there experiencing life and a very short life. And if you have good weather and a good team and everything works out, you stand on the summit. But it's not like we spike our ice axes on the summit and hoopla and all that. It's like, okay, we got through another one. What's up next?
What was your first significant climb?
Oh, the first time I went climbing with my dad and his buddies was probably the first, like the significant one, doing Wind Ridge and El Dorado Canyon and sneakers as a teenager was another sort of breakthrough. But the first significant climb was probably 1987 to the Kachatna Spires. And we drove a Ford Econoline up from Utah and went climbing and then came back out and drove back down. So that was we received a grant from the American Alpine Club for $400, and we're living large.
You had a mentor when you were a young climber, as most do. What was the most important lesson Mug Stump taught you?
Yeah, Muggs was an athlete by birth, so to say. He played football, and he was enjoyed that. So the pursuit of athleticism was something that he was drawn to. But then he discovered climbing at age 26, about the age your body starts to transition from football. And so he was very mindful that that climbing was his calling. And so it was an encouragement to go out and pursue it and to try my best. So that was probably the knowledge that I could go do something like that, and the affirmation and the confidence that he brought to me.
And he was killed on a climb in Denali, May 21st, 1992.
Yeah, he lost his life there. Yeah. And that's the downside of what we do. It's kind of high. There's a big price that we pay.
You were 29 at the time. It must have been devastating news. Other than sadness, obviously, and shock, what was your reaction? I mean, you could have gone either way with that. You could have become disillusioned with climbing a bit and stepped away, or you could have only possibly strengthened your resolve and climbed harder mm-hmm. and more fervently. You know, if only in his honor, you know, doing it for Muggs.
Yeah. I don't think it was never like, oh, to do it in his honor or anything like that. But it was knowledge that, you know, prior to that, I thought, oh, things happen, but it happens to someone else, someone less prepared. And we had the strength of confidence and this sense of invincibility that we went with. But it was, the downside was that it doesn't always hold true. So I think I'm hardwired to go climbing. So it's how I soothe myself and balance myself in this oversubscribed world.
So you never felt like any kind of a disillusionment or, you know, maybe I should take a break from this and anything like that. You just kept on going.
Well, I do take breaks. So after a moment like that, there's definitely... I didn't go on expeditions for a while, but yeah, there's all sorts of worn out adages. Oh, he died with his boots on, or he died what he loved doing, or he would be proud if you were to continue that. And you can be gender neutral in that too. But those are things that we tell ourselves, and that decision to keep climbing is an individual choice.
At what point in your life did you begin to think of climbing or mountaineering as a career choice? I mean, not something you could just do for fun, but something you can actually be.
Good question. About age 14, I realized that was where I was happiest, was to be in the mountains and to be out there with people. And that was my wellspring of happiness, so to say, but I didn't realize I was able to make a living out of it. When I was at university in Salt Lake City, at the University of Utah, I had work study at the outdoor program. And so that was recreation-based, people going rafting and teaching climbing, things like that. And then also had a job at a gear shop. So the sense that there's a professional climber that gets paid to climb all the time, maybe there's a few of them, but I work within the business and I've always found a way that I bring value to brands that media companies, but it's not necessarily the ball sports and puck sports, and we're just sort of out here on the periphery.
The year of 1999 was a consequential one for you. In May of that year, you discovered George Mallory's body on Mount Everest. Now, for our listeners who may not be aware or may not know who he is, who was George Mallory?
George Mallory was going back 100 years to 1912. He was one of the first climbers from England to go to Mount Everest. So that was 21, 22, and 24. And it was 23, they realized that what they had to do, plan ahead. So 24 was their last trip that they went out on. And it was June 8th, 1924. Wow. It's
almost 100 years.
Yeah. That 98 years. So yeah, it's pretty, he disappeared as on their attempt to get to the summit. Noel O'Dell was the last to see them and had written in the book that they were moving expeditiously as if to make up for lost time. And the question became, could they have made it to the summit some 29 years before Tenzing Norgay and Ed Hillary did? And that was sort of the big question. In the Chinese discovered an English dead on their expedition in 1975. And that was kind of knew about that. And then I was invited on an expedition in 1999 to take part in looking for George Mallory.
I read some of the transcripts of the radio communications you had with your team on that day. And it appears that when you found the body, they believed at first, your team members, that it was the body of Andrew Irvine, who was Mallory's climbing partner. And that would have been significant because I think they thought he had a camera maybe on him that had film, which could have possibly proven whether they actually reached the summit.
Yeah, so a couple things. If they had made the summit on that June 8th, 1924, and they had taken a photograph, and you could see the Lhotse and Nupse, which are not visible from the north side of Everest, then we'd have proof that they did. But it was cloudy that day from noon until probably an hour or two after sunset when clouds dissipate, sort of normal mountain weather patterns. When it's warm and humid, the clouds form. Then when it cools off at night, they dissipate. So whether that Kodak vest pocket camera would have the information in it is unknown, but that was the thing. And then the other, we thought it was going to be Sandy Irvin, in part because Tom Holtzell and Audrey Salkeld had written a book, Mystery on Everest. And in the end of the book, they had these theories about who that English dead might be and what might have transpired. And so Tom Holtzell had a view on that. And that was what his, we kind of had read that. And that's kind of what we thought was going on.
But it turned out it was Mallory's body. And from the transcripts of the radio transmissions, they were, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. But you were very quiet. And you said later that finding his body was a humbling experience. Why was that to you humbling?
You know, if you're in this game long enough, you have to make peace with mortality and your own death. So, and then also climbing is a generational activity. So what he was able to do set the stage for the 1953 expedition and then on through the 60s, 70s, 80s. And then when it was my turn in the 90s, that body of knowledge has been passed on through climbers. And that was so you approach those people with respect and reverence.
Apparently you did, just based on the conversation at the time. That that discovery made you somewhat famous, didn't it?
Yeah, I went from in the climbing world to being in a tabloid. So
it brought some criticism too of you personally. And what was the reason for that criticism? What was the core reason?
Yeah, that it should be left undisturbed, the bodies of people that are on the mountains. But we had approached this with permission of the families and the manner in which the news was shared and the photographs and the story went to the highest bidder.
Tabloid, which
is owned by the man that will not be named. That's this serious disinformation.
Who you're talking about.
There was that understanding there that Wade Davis, who wrote In the Shadow of Everest, a book about that, he has his own theories about what the upset, you know, why it was upset. But yeah, I was a young climber and I was invited on the expedition. Well, not that young, 36. So yeah, went along.
Irvin's body had never been found. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Then just 5 months after that disaster in Tibet, can you describe what happened on Shishgumangpa on October 5th?
So Shishgumangpa is the 14th highest peak. It's entirely within Tibet. So occupied by the Chinese. So we won't make it past the the great cyber wall on this one. But Alex Lowe and I were on expedition.
And Alex, at this point, is your climbing partner, your best friend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so we were in along with David Bridges, who was the camera person on that. And we, unfortunately, an avalanche triggered, you know, on the morning of October 5th, and it took the lives of David and Alex.
And you saw the avalanche coming. They went one way. You went a different way. I think you went like sideways to the direction of the avalanche.
Yeah, contoured on the terrain, which was on a glacier, and then they went in a different direction. And we checked on each other, but it was a matter of seconds and minutes, and then it was, you know, my life had changed.
And so others too, by the way. You had to make the call to Jenny with the news, and you struggled with survivor's guilt for quite some time after that. I heard you say, it should have been me, unquote. Now, is this thinking just a kind of condition of emotional trauma? I mean, there's no logical or rational reason why, quote unquote, fate should spare you while taking your friends, or vice versa, is there?
Yeah, it was a difficult moment to share that news with Jenny. It's still, you know, we have a great family, but yeah, we're governed by the laws of the universe, which the foundation of that is gravity. So fate and something up there that's bigger than us. It was timing and bad luck and just split decision to run sideways as opposed to where my friends went. So there was, but yeah, it now I see that in other, particularly young climbers that have lost someone, what that is. So,
and then most probably know this, but not everyone, obviously, but you committed yourself to helping Alex's family, Jenny and the three boys, which you did. And during that time, you and Jenny fell in love, were married. Just a couple of years later, you adopted the three boys, you helped raise them, and you've been married now for 20 years.
Yeah, I'm going on 21 years now. So
I wanted to segue from that to Max, the oldest of the three boys, and his recent documentary he made. How proud must you be of Max for directing Torn? Can you talk a little bit about the film, perhaps on Max's behalf?
Yeah, Torn is a documentary. It's with Nat Geo Documentaries and available at Disney Plus if you want to watch it. So it chronicles our life and asks a bunch of questions about where we are, where we've been, and sort of that story. So to have our story told by one of us is pretty meaningful.
So just a couple other events I want to ask before we get to Galen. In 2012, you climbed Everest again, your third summit this time, without supplemental oxygen. I don't think most people know or understand what a feat that is. So I have a couple questions with regard to that. Number one, why did you do it? You were almost 50 years old, or were you 50 at that time? Most of your team were half your age, and they went with you, and they used oxygen. So why did you do this, and why without oxygen?
Yeah, I was 49 at the time, and yeah, just to climb the mountain by fair means, and it's still the infrastructure that's there, the fixed rope and the tent platforms and the track that other people stomp in really makes a huge difference. So when you're post-holing and wading through deeper snow, it requires more effort. But in this case, it was ability to follow the track. So the first time I went to Everest was the discovery of Mallory in 99. And then the second time, free climbed the second step for the film, The Wildest Dream. And then this third time did it without oxygen. So I wanted to kind of round out what I'd done with it.
And my second question with regard to that expedition is, what did the researchers and doctors at the Mayo Clinic discover or learn after testing you afterward? I mean, aside from the fact that you're superhuman, of course.
I'm not superhuman. I trashed my body in the process of doing that, becoming very dehydrated and you're just looking at the urine samples and things like that. But probably one of the takeaways of that is that you can measure the human body for performance and everything like that, but it doesn't necessarily predicate success at altitude. So a large part of that is your mental fortitude and your ability to withstand pain. So that's my own takeaway. It's not documented or anything like that. So
it's nothing physical. It's mental and it's fortitude.
There's certainly a physical component to it, but it, some of the great altitude climbers were not good at that. So having large volume lungs and having a high oxygen perfusion, so being able to get that oxygen in your lungs into your blood is a marker of being able to do well at altitude.
And in 2016, you suffered a heart attack while climbing a remote Himalayan wall of rock and ice. I'm sorry, I don't remember the name of the mountain, but you were at 20,000 feet and you realize you're having a heart attack.
Yeah, I was on Lunagiri. And I think that might have been complications from earlier when I'd been on Everest, and that it would, and that somehow I had compromised my system. I think altitude is very hard on the body, more than we understand, just because it's not studied in that level of depth that we look at other human ailments.
So you're at 20,000 feet, you're up on the wall, you're having a heart attack. How did you get down? How did you get help? How did you get any kind of medical care? How long did it take?
It was, we were rappelled off the face. I was with David Lama, and then hitchhiked a ride on a helicopter. And it was 9 hours from onset to when I had a stent put in my, at the hospital in Kathmandu.
Wow. That's probably a very painful experience too, for that long a period of time.
Yeah, it was help. Just suffering.
Apparently you like that.
Yeah, maybe so.
Talk about Galen a little bit. Galen Rao, one of my heroes, as I mentioned. How did you two meet, and into what circumstances and where?
Oh, we met probably maybe in the early 80s, mid 80s or something like that in Tuolumne Meadows. And then we were friends, we knew of him, but it wasn't until I moved to the Bay Area in 1995 to take on a marketing job at the North Face, and he was there living in Berkeley. So we then became climbing partners and would take trips up to the Sierras and went to Pakistan in 97. And then 2002, we went to Tibet with Rick Ridgway and Jimmy Chin. So yeah, great guy.
I read a piece that you wrote about him. You commented on his energy, his athleticism, even when he was 60 plus. Coming from you, that's something. He must have been a beast, I guess, what I'm saying.
Yeah, he was always motivated, and especially for photography and finding that magic light. And to be on that trip to the Chungtong in 2002, where he mentored Jimmy and shared much of his knowledge and experience, it was a precious moment in my life.
Yeah, I was going to mention that you probably worked with a lot of photographers, but the two that really stand out, at least to me, are Galen and Jimmy Chin. Now, I was going to ask you, you know, in what ways, just based on what you observed, what ways were they similar and in what ways were they different?
They're both similar in that they were motivated and they could identify when good light was, and they never missed it. So when there's good light, they're always out working with their camera. And then it's a lot of it is choreography with the camera person and the person that's in the frame. So working together in that sense. And Galen was at the very end of the analog world when we still used film emulsion. And now it's all digital. And so just as he passed away some 20 years ago, it was just sort of coming around to the digital technology. And of course, now it's so far advanced and the resolution is so clear that
I can only imagine what he could do with today's technology, really.
Yeah. Yeah, the graduated filters and lenses, and there's always something that you snap a photograph and you have no idea what it was like until you got home and you had the film processed. You'd have cassette after cassette of film in there, and then you'd have to make it home to do that. So Yeah.
He had a rare combination of intelligence, eloquence, vision, physical strength, all in one person. I can see why you were drawn to each other as friends.
Yeah. Yeah, we shared a love of the mountains, and it's this fascination of being outdoors and doing as much as you can. That was our grounding moment. So
I spoke with Franz Lanting, who was also a friend of Galen's. We were at an event. We were both guest speakers. And after hours, the conversation turned to Galen, and he said there were some images that only he could have taken because of his physical abilities, which were far and away greater than almost all the other photographers. Wondering if you have a favorite Galen memory or experience or trip that you would like to share.
We did the Nose in the Day, kind of a fun one. It's a route up El Capitan, so it's some 30 pitches, and being able to do that start to finish. So that was really kind of a fun thing. And then trips that we'd went in the Sierras, going up and climbing there. A very fast driver, I remember just being like, wow. I mean,
we'll ask. just how bad of a driver was he?
It wasn't bad. He was just fast and just so, I'm always a cautious driver. So do everything I can to not get pulled over. One on that is don't speed. So,
of course, Galen and his wife, Barbara, were both tragically killed in a plane crash in 2002. And you contributed to an essay titled Icon of Adventure Photography in the book Galen Rau, A Retrospective, which was published several years after his death. It's a moving and beautiful essay, by the way. And in it, I'm going to quote you here. Good fun can only be found in discomfort and hardship. So you care to elaborate.
Humans, we want to challenge ourselves and try something that's out of our comfort zone. And a photographer can take you to that place, then you have a window into their soul and also a window into your own soul. And mountaineering and adventures, we do that by our own volition. There's no one asking us to do it. So it's very different than war photography or journalism, where you're seeing discomfort and people being out of their comfort zone as a result of that. So there's always a little bit of fascination, like, wow, how did they do that? Or how did they get there? So that kind of combination to it.
And Galen was a fierce defender of wild places. You've also been a strong advocate for wilderness and the environment as well, the planet. Now that you've scaled back on your climbing a bit, do you see yourself now taking a more active role or having a more active voice on behalf of the environment, an ambassador for the earth, sort of?
Yeah. We're only here for a short time. So there, make the most of your life that you're with. And it's interesting. Our generation, we now understand the ramifications of the carbon that we've been consuming. So prior to the Industrial Revolution, everything was pretty much solar based, whether it was wood, which took time to grow and then to consume into fire, and then plants, obviously the seasonal cycles. And then all of a sudden we started mining coal and then oil. And so we have this solar energy that was trapped during the Carboniferous time, and then we're now releasing it, and that carbon in the atmosphere is drastically changing it. And Galen was always very loved the wild places and the preserving them in a wild and natural state for human enjoyment. The understanding we now have of the effect of humans on our climate and what's going forward in the next 200 years is different than what he had experienced at the time.
In a documentary, Meru, you're obviously the leader of the group. You're the oldest. And even though the three of you are similar talents and abilities, you were always encouraging, always pushing, always the optimist. Are you just an optimist by nature? Are you optimistic about the environment?
Yeah, I'm an optimist by nature. So I'm, I'm an atheist. I'm an optimist. I'm a fatalist. I believe in gravity. So I'm like everyone's not favorite person on in that sense. But we only have this one life, and you want to make the most of it. And so experiences are the juice of our existence. And so the more juice you can experience, the more sweet life's going to be.
You've certainly done that. At this stage in your career today, I mean, what sort of things do you worry about, if you worry at all? I mean, does anything keep you up at night?
I mean, we've just seen the world change so dramatically in the last 2 years. So the global pandemic, the rise of authoritarianism, also coming to terms with racial reckoning, 500 years of slavery here in the United States, and centuries of imperialism out of Europe, and how do we make the world a more equitable and fair place? And for as a citizen of the United States, which has been this beacon of democracy and fairness, to see that erode away because of greed and the values that we base outdoor experiences on, that we need to cooperate for a shared goal, they're pretty meaningful. And it's a great way of for humans to interact with other humans in that sense. It's why we rejuvenate when we go outdoors. But to have a minority rule that wants to tell everyone else what to do, but doesn't want to be told what to do, and has the power to keep that in place at the expense of others, is a bit troubling. And I refer back to my mother, who passed away, but she was born in 1933 in a village outside of Dresden. So she saw the rise of the Third Reich, and then at age 13, the firebombing of Dresden. So for her, the war was like real. There wasn't something to be patriotic about. It was like, you're not going to be, I mean, that's why I'm a pacifist. I don't, you know, we need to find ways to solve these without. And, you know, here we are today, and we're, 18,000 people in the United States have lost their lives to guns in just 6 months. And that's just 1 year. So, you know, what is it worth it? And it's definitely a question. So those sort of things keep me up at night. I'm not going to do any great climbs anymore. I'm just going to take it easy.
You've done some mentoring. You've got a program that involved Black teens. You want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, the outdoors, they're, well, not intentional, or perhaps for some people it has been intentional, but it's just been a white space. And to see the benefit of being outdoors, where you communicate with other people and have a good time, you enjoy the sunrise and cooking together, and those are really great experiences to have that build trust between humans. And so in working with Memphis Rocks and Tom Shidiak and the team there in Memphis, with being able to take those value set of climbing and share it with a population that is disadvantaged, especially there in South Memphis, is a good example of that. So if I have an opportunity to mentor, how far will that mentorship go? And to help out other people is certainly the benefit to it. But the biggest change within that is indoor climbing gyms, which were not around when I started climbing, but now you can have a climbing gym in places where there are no cliffs. So someplace like Columbus, Ohio is flat, but you have a climbing wall and you can go climbing on it. And that people come in there and hopefully they see it as a safe space and one that is encouraging.
These indoor climbing walls, they are doing the climbing, which is great. I mean, it's great exercise, it's good physically, but they're missing out on the outdoor experience. That's a big part of the climbing experience.
It's two different things. Perhaps climbing gyms can be an introduction to the outdoors, and then you take the skills you've learned there outdoors. But many people come to climbing gyms without really being steeped in outdoor practices. And I came to climbing because I was introduced to it at a young age, and it's what we did. And my father did it. So that was, I had the good fortune of being able to share that. But the climbing gyms May they be a way to introduce people to the outdoors. And so think of the positive side of that. And if you go bowling, anyway, it's great. Yeah, bowling's great and wonderful, but you're not going to be like, oh, I'm going to go outdoors after I went bowling. You're just going to go bowling again or something like that. Whereas if you're like, oh, I had a great time climbing these artificial holds in a gym, what's it going to be like if I go outdoors and climb in a natural setting? So your interest is piqued by that.
Be good, be kind, be happy.
Yeah.
This is your self-described motto. It's plastered on your website. So where did this come from? I think I have an idea. And what does it mean to you personally? And what are you trying to say by putting it out there as your motto?
Well, goodness and kindness equal happiness. So if you're looking for happiness, find goodness and kindness. So you can be, I don't know, I just put it up there decades ago. So maybe I'm putting up these expectations for myself. A little something there to guide your life, and doesn't, being courteous to people doesn't take a lot.
I like it.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
And it's Elvis Costello, right?
I don't know if Delbert McClinton.
Okay.
He maybe did write those six words, right? But he did have an album. I think it was Be Happy or Get Happy that came out in like the
Get early. Happy.
Yeah. Get Happy. Yeah. And so that was probably influenced by his music.
Be good, be kind, be happy. This feels like the perfect way to wrap this up. A good way to end.
Well, thank you, Richard. Great questions. And it's nice to have a photographer ask these and to look into the history and what photography is to the outdoors. It's an integral part of how we experience it.
Yeah, and how we share it with others who don't have the privilege of seeing some of the things that you've seen and I've seen. Boys and girls at home, you can learn more about this amazing guy on his website, conradanker.com. That's conradanker.com. Conrad, you're on Twitter and Instagram too.
Yeah.
At Conrad_anker.
Yep, that's correct.
Be good, be kind, be happy. Thank you, Conrad. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Richard. And best to you and your team. And may our paths cross in person one of these days.
You've been listening to Beyond the Lens with me, Richard Burnaby. Thank you to my guest, Conrad Anker, for this amazing conversation. And thanks to you, of course, for listening. Tweet me at Burnaby Photo with any comments or feedback. If you enjoyed the show, please share a link on social media. You can sign up to receive an email when a new episode drops at our website, beyondthelens.fm. Here's to truth, adventure, and passion. See you next time.
Well, wasn't that amazing? It was created and produced by podcast partners. They're really lovely people and rather good at all this podcasting guff. Find out more at podcastpartners.com.